Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Saturday, August 3rd, 2002. Today's session is titled, Vision for Better or Worse, a presentation on the eye and vision problems, presented by Ronald Lang. The number is LAR2002-01. Let's listen in.
Physiology and then how it works, and then ask questions of what kinds of questions you have, and then related to that. But since we have a little time before we start, people are still coming. Let me ask you first, what kinds of things would you like to know about that? What are the problems that you have that you don't understand or that you want to learn more about or that your eye doctor hasn't told you sufficiently well?
Cataracts and glaucoma.
Cataracts and glaucoma, okay?
And floaters.
Floaters, okay?
Oh, yeah. Right.
What?
Floaters.
Floaters, yeah.
Macular degeneration. Okay. How about headaches? Headaches that center
right behind the eye.
Okay.
How about supplements?
What was that?
Supplements. I hear in Portland on the radio all the time, they're always advertising eye health, some supplement that's supposed to help your vision, make your vision.
We like carrots.
I think I hear Paul Harvey or somebody.
How about the stroke of the eye? I was talking to a person who had she described a stroke in her eye. I don't know what you would call that.
Let's call it stroke of the eye.
Okay.
How about that?
Perfect.
The thing I'm surprised nobody asked about is laser surgery.
Yeah, I was about to say.
If you don't hear it, tell us anyway. That's one of the hot topics.
Yeah, the good and bad of things about it. Huh?
Well, I'll tell you the good and bad things about it.
Yes.
Cover pretty much.
Oh, why do some people need bright lights?
Why do some people what?
Need bright lights on all the time.
In order to see?
Yeah.
Presbyopia. Well, bright light bothers my eyes at night driving. Coming at me.
Okay, glare.
Glare coming at me.
That's up here. Well, it's partly up here and it's partly down here. Two main causes of glare. One is aging made and the other is surgery made.
Halos around, like the moon at night.
Halos.
That goes under cataract.
Could also be surgery, though.
Yeah, it also goes under laser surgery. That's plenty. That's more than enough to talk about. But if anybody has a burning question, now is the time to ask. Okay, let me go over the anatomy of the eye so that we can kind of understand what I'm going to talk about here. And I apologize for some of the terminology, but medicine, like every other field, has a jargon and a unique language that they use to communicate with one another. And it is a foreign language to people who are not in medicine. And one of the first things, of course, I had to learn when I got into medicine probably 30 years ago was I had to learn the jargon. I had to learn how to communicate with the physician and the ophthalmologist and the doctors. And my language was that of physics, not of physical science, not of, of medicine. So I had to learn all this jargon. And it is learnable. And it does make some sense, but it's not obvious at first. So I will try to use as little medical jargon as I can. But some, unfortunately, I probably should use, because if you go back and talk to your eye doctor, why, he will use that jargon too. It's not necessarily to confuse you, but it sometimes serves that purpose. So if we look straight at somebody's eye, I've drawn this picture, and we see the upper lid and the lower lid, and we see the eye, we see the iris, the colored part of the eye, and it has a pretty structure, and it's unique. People can use pictures of the iris to identify individuals, and that's one of the ways that people, some companies now are screening for is the person who's turning in the credit card or something, the person, the real person that's there, the person going into the secret room to see the person that is on the card. So the iris is quite different from one person to another, not just in color, but in the structure of it. The thing right in the iris is the pupil, and that's the black spot. That's where the light goes through to get to the back of the eye. And the pupil can change its diameter because the pupil can get bigger or smaller. In dim light, it gets bigger to let in more light. And in bright light, it gets smaller to let in less light. So that the light that gets to the back of the eye tries to stay pretty much constant. And it does that by closing the pupil or opening it. There are diseases of the iris and the pupil. I won't talk about those because nobody asked about them, but there can be diseases in almost every part of the body, and certainly the eye is a very complex structure. There are diseases in every part of the eye. If I look at the side of you, and I look at your eye, about an inch in diameter in the average human eye, and I sort of take a cross-section of the eye. I imagine that I sort of take my slab saw, and I slab your eye, and I make a little thin section right through the middle. For those of you who've been to the lapidary shop, you understand that. This is what the slab would look like. This is what a section to the middle of the eye, your eye, would look like. This is the cornea here, the part that if you poke your finger in your eye, your finger hits the cornea first. And so this is the cornea. So light is normally coming in this way. The cornea, here is the iris in back, and here's the pupil in the middle, this pupil. And then in back of that is the crystalline lens. And it is a lens. The medical person always refers to it as a crystalline lens because there are other kinds of lenses in the eye. In fact, the cornea is the most powerful lens of the eye. That's what mostly determines whether the light is going to focus on your retina or not, whether you can see without glasses or whether you need glasses. But this is the crystalline lens, and it's shaped somewhat like an onion. It has a lot of layers, like an onion. And that's where the cataract develops. As we age, the crystalline lens of the eye changes. And about the age 40, the conventional wisdom is that at age 40, in every person, the lens changes, and it starts getting a cataract. And it can get different kinds of cataracts. Some are progress very rapidly, some progress very slowly, and some people, they'll have to have their cataracts out when they're 40 because their lens gets cloudy and you can't get light through it, so they can't image things on the retina. And other people, I mean, they'll be 80, 90 years old. Some people often die before they have
that. Can you do a cataract more than once?
No, you can only do it once, because once you've taken, the cataract is in the lens. A cataract is a cloudy crystalline lens, or a crystalline lens that's partly cloudy. It's sufficiently cloudy that you can't get light through it to the retina where the photoreceptors are. So once you've taken it out, you can't, there's nothing left to take out. Now these days, when they take out the cataract, they usually put in an intraocular lens. It's a little plastic lens about the shape and size of the human lens. And they put it in and they fasten with these things called loops. And it sort of makes up for the optical properties of the real crystal lens. That was made, the ability to put in these little lenses was made possible by an instrument that looked at the corneal endothelium. I'll tell you in a minute why that's important. And that instrument was developed, 28 years ago, actually in my laboratory. I was the one who did it, and we developed this lens, this special kind of camera that we could photograph the corneal endothelium in people, and that made possible the development of new types of lenses that would go in here that would not damage, that would not cause blindness, which a lot of the early ones were, and made possible use of these intraocular lenses. They're put in essentially universally now. Almost everybody has one in after cataract surgery. That means that after the cataract surgery, we no longer have to wear these thick Coke bottle glasses that people had to wear before. Those glasses had the problem that you only had a very narrow field of vision. And they were heavy and not nice to wear, but you had a very narrow field. With the intraocular lens, you have this wide field of vision. The only problem with those lenses is why they don't focus, like the natural crystal lens. The crystal lens has little muscles attached here to its sides, and these muscles pull on the lens or relax and let it, and that changes the focusing power of the lens so that the light will focus back here on the retina. The artificial lenses that they put in don't have that ability, although people are working on focusable lenses. They first started in Japan probably 15 years ago.
How do you compensate for that?
For what?
For the fact that it doesn't focus.
You wear glasses. You put on glasses. You will either have to wear glasses to read or to see in the distance when you've had your cataracts out. You completely lose the ability to focus.
Mm-hmm. So comparable with glasses.
Well, I mean, they will try to pick an intraocular lens, a plastic lens to put in that will correct your vision for either distance or reading or in between. Maybe what you can tell them what you want. Mm-hmm. If you say, I work at the computer terminal all day long, I don't want to wear glasses working, they can, in principle, pick a lens that will mean that you won't have to wear glasses looking at the terminal. But then if you're looking in the day, if you're driving, you'll need to wear glasses to drive. Or you could say, you know, I'm a truck driver. I need to be able to see in the distance. They can put in a lens that will enable you to see in the distance without glasses, then you'll have to have glasses to read. Now in practice, they can't always do that as well as they would like. Like every other field, some people can do a little better than others, and sometimes it's successful and sometimes it's not. Yes?
I am nearsighted, I have very severe astigmatism. Mm. Would they factor all of these things in? And you know, would I wear glasses that would take care of all that stuff at one time, like trifocals, or would I be switching glasses to do different things?
Astigmatism is a property of the cornea, where the cornea, instead of being nice and spherical,
so it
looks like a cabochon. If you've been to the laboratory, it looks like a cabochon rather than a sphere.
Right.
It has a different curvature in one direction than the other. And that causes this thing we call astigmatism, where if you're looking at, let's say, lines like this, some of the lines will be sharp and others will be very blurry. That currently has to be corrected by glasses. There are some new contact lenses that have come out that claim to correct for astigmatism. They have to be put on in a certain way. They don't rotate. They're very experimental. They've only been around a couple of years.
I did not have good luck with contact lenses.
A lot of people don't. They're very new, and you know, 10 years from now, they'll have them that work well or something. Maybe. But right now, they're so. If they didn't work for you, that's not surprising. I think they don't work for a lot of people, but for some, they do.
But at the time, I may need cataract surgery. Am I going to be switching lenses? That's my question. Am I going to be picking up a pair of glasses for one thing?
Well, when you have cataract surgery, you won't be able to change your focus. So, which probably you can now. You're young enough that you probably have some focusing ability. As we age, we get less and less focusing ability. When we're very young, we can focus way in the distance, and we can focus way up close. And as we age, what happens is that the lens gets hard. It gets hard. And this is one of the things that happens at age 40. You know, plus or minus one day, it happens every hour. It's very precise. I'm not sure I believe that anymore, but that's the conventional wisdom. And the lens gets hard. It gets cloudy, and it gets hard, and it can get uniformly cloudy, or it can get little spots back here, little fluid pockets with CHEF structure. We saw them with this specular microscope in my lab that we had for the first time. And they're little fatty globules, I guess you'd call them. That's called posterior subcapsular cataract. When you get it, it happens very fast, and it happens usually at a fairly early age. That's probably the worst kind of cataract, and you have to take out the lens in order to get rid of it. This diffuse cataract that you get happens usually much more slowly, and nobody quite knows why in some people it happens fast and why in other people it happens slowly, but it's probably dietary related. It's probably related to smoking. It's related to environmental things. If you're around polluted air and whatnot, that doesn't help the eye at all. If you eat a lot of fatty food, you're a big meat eater and stuff, that doesn't help the eye. The diet here at Holden is probably a good diet for your eye. I'm not sure I would want to eat it all the time. I'm looking forward to a hamburger and french fries when I get back, but it's a pretty good diet. The carrots are good for the eye for various reasons.
What about sunglasses?
You should always wear sunglasses because you can get a cataract due to ultraviolet. There's a type of cataract called a welder's cataract that welders used to get because they used to, 50 years ago, they didn't, I don't want to wear glasses, you know. And they would develop a cataract because the UV would be absorbed in the lens and cause changes that would result in a cataract. So, yeah, always wear sunglasses outside.
Starting when you're very young.
Always wear sunglasses.
I think so. If it's bright enough, it always
wears sunglasses. Kind of bother my eyes. And so my wife puts them on, I don't.
But you see, you don't know what's happening in your crystal lens. You can't see that. And that's what's going to be changed by. It'll hit you later.
I already got you.
I just haven't cried.
Is one color sunglass better than another?
I don't think so. The important thing is that they block the ultraviolet. And now the sunglasses we buy in the United States, they say UV blocking and blocks type A and type B and all that. Get them where it blocks both A and B. And it does make a difference with the colors, I think. The yellow ones are a little better in the late afternoon because it helps the contrast. Yellow will block out the blue light, which scatters very much in the cataract. Yeah.
Does the UV coating they put on lenses, if you choose to have it, does that block out those
lenses? That's what it's supposed to do, yeah.
But they're not sunglasses.
They're not sunglasses, but they will block out that, that's good to have. Anything that blocks UV from the eye is good. It doesn't hurt anything. It's not expensive to have. And how much it helps, I don't know, but it certainly is a help. So that's because cataracts are associated with this. Depending on the type, we asked about glare and halos, a lot of times at night, as you get older, you find that the oncoming cars, the headlights of the oncoming cars sort of blind you. You lose contrast. You can't read the sign at the side of the road. You can't see the small child walking along there in dark colored clothing. Because of the glare, the light coming in. And what happens is that the light comes in and this lens is sort of cloudy. It's as if it had milk in it. If you take a glass of milk, of diluted milk, and you try to shine light through it, the milk scatters. It goes in all directions. So the light comes in and it kind of scatters. Instead of focusing sharply on the retina here, the red part, it scatters around and the image gets blurry. And the contrast goes down. The difference between the blacks and whites decrease. So you cannot distinguish black from dark gray like you can in the daytime. The daytime, we can see different shades of blackness or grayness very easily. At night, with oncoming headlights, we lose that ability. And you lose it more the more advanced your cataract is. So that's if when you get to the point where the glare is so bad that you really say, gee, it's dangerous for me to drive, you want to go to the ophthalmologist and have cataracts taken out, probably. Or at least go to him and let him decide whether they're called ripe. When they're ready to be taken, it's a ripe cataract. And but that's probably due to that. Unless you have corneal problems, and then there's a different situation. There's a different kind of glare with the cornea. So that's the crystal lens. And the light goes through, and it gets back here to the retina, which is in the back of the eye. The terminology is that things in the back are called posterior. This is the posterior capsule, and the front is the anterior. The anterior capsule is this part. And eye doctors specialize either in the anterior part of the eye or the posterior part. None of them specialize in both. It's very well divided. So in the back of the eye, there's the retina, which I sort of drawn in red. And that's where the photoreceptors are. And then sort of in the back of that is this sclera, this white hard part of the eye that we see. And the retina has a number of layers. It has, and this is going this way. This is anterior and posterior this way. So the light is coming in this way. The retina is here. Behind that is a nerve fiber layer, which has embedded in it the photoreceptors. Behind that is a layer of very, very fine blood vessels called the choriocapillaris. Capillaris sort of meaning small. And so this is the choriocapillaris. Behind that is the choroid, which is big blood vessels. And behind that is the sclera, this sort of white encapsulated part of the eye. And the blood, the photoreceptors, there's two kinds of photoreceptors. There's rods and there's cones. And they're sensitive to different colors of light. The cones are sensitive to colors, all colors. Well, not all colors, but from blue to red, we can see. We don't see ultraviolet. We saw in the lapidary shop that ultraviolet will make rocks fluoresce and such, but we don't see the ultraviolet. Some animals do, bees do, and other animals do. We don't, but the cones are color sensitive. Then we have rods, and I've drawn these sort of cone-shaped and I've drawn these rod-shaped because that's kind of what they look like. They are cone-shaped or rod-shaped, which is why they're called rods and cones. There are rods, and rods are not sensitive to color. They're only sensitive to the intensity of light. So they see in black and white. And you say, well, why do we have such things? Well, we have such things for protection. When we were hunter-gatherers or something, we needed those. Because rods are very sensitive to light. Cones are not so sensitive. To use your cone vision, you have to have fairly bright lights. To use your rod vision, you don't. So when you are in the dark, walking down to the bathroom or something, and it's dark, and everything looks black and white to you, you are using your rod vision. You're using the rods. They are the ones that are sensitive to this dim light. And you will, if you notice, you will notice that you're not seeing anything in color if the light is dim enough. It's all just grays. So the cones are very useful because they enable us to get around in not absolute blackness, but near blackness.
Well, if you're colorblind, are you missing one of those?
That's different. If you're colorblind, then that's a problem of the cones, that they don't see certain colors. That's a cone problem. But rods are, no, there's no color. And so the sensitive part of the photoreceptor, whether it's a rod or a cone, is in the back of the retina, or the back of this layer. So the light has to go through this tissue in order to get to the photoreceptor where you would see it as light. And so any problem in here will cause you not to be able to see. And there are a number of problems in here. Associated with diabetes and various other things. The choriocapillaris back here is this very fine blood layer, just a mass of blood vessels. The blood and the choroid behind it are the bigger vessels. So the blood comes into the choroid, then goes into the choriocapillaris, which is this fine meshwork. And the blood serves two purposes in the body, and particularly in the eye. In the body, it serves the purpose of bringing nutrients to the tissues and taking away the waste products of metabolism. When the cells use glucose largely to do whatever they're supposed to do, the muscle uses glucose to be able to move or to walk or something. Glucose is found in sugars are complex types, things break down into glucose, but honey has a lot of glucose in it, and that's why honey is good. Orange juice has a lot of, that's why when you take some honey or orange when you're tired hiking, you get renewed energy because you're giving energy to the cells of the body. So the photoreceptors need a lot of energy. I mean, they work really hard. They work, and except when you're sleeping, they're working a lot. They need a lot of food. They need a lot of energy, and they primarily use glucose. In order to get the glucose, it comes in the blood. The blood carries the glucose to the photoreceptors. The glucose comes through the walls of these very fine blood vessels, and it gets to the photoreceptors, which use it to be able to see, to do these biochemical processes that we call vision. They convert the light into an electrical impulse, which then goes to the nerves, this layer here, I haven't drawn them, but it's full of nerves. The nerves take this electrical impulse and they take it up to this area here, the nerve head, which is the blind spot, and the nerves go up to the blind spot, and here, so they go into the brain, and the brain then puts these electrical signals together into an image that we see. You need to have a lot of energy. They have to get a lot of glucose. Well, they get it from the blood. So if you have an awful lot of blood there, you'll get an awful lot of energy. And the thickness or the density or the number of blood vessels in the choriocapillaris is larger than in any other part of the body. Larger than any other part of the body because the photoreceptors need a lot of energy. As an aside, one of the things they also need is vitamin A. Vitamin A is essential for vision. We in the United States don't have too much problem with getting enough vitamin A. We get it in our foods. One of the major sources of blindness in the world back 20 years ago in various countries like India was people were blind because of vitamin A deficiency. And you could cure their blindness by giving them a vitamin A tablet every day. And and they did that. They sent over a lot of vitamin tablets and they tried to get them to change their diet. That cured blindness of tens of millions of people. It was amazing. You need vitamin A. Carrots have a lot of vitamin A, so they serve carrots here to protect us. So. But the other thing that's needed is that the vision process, like almost everything we do, generates heat. When we walk, we get warm, right? We all know that. You walk uphill, you get hot, and you take off your outer clothing. When the cells of the body do something, do what they're supposed to do, they often get hot. And the photoreceptors do the same things. They get hot. You have to carry that heat away. Otherwise, they're going to destroy themselves. You polish a rock and you get it too hot, it comes off the dop stick. Lapidary is just like the eye in a lot of ways. So you have to get the heat away so that the photoreceptors don't get too hot and stop working. And the choriocapillaris does that. It also carries away the heat. It brings, sort of warm blood up to it has to be warm enough to work. So it brings warm blood up to the area of the photoreceptors, and it carries away hot blood, if you want. The third thing that has to be done in the photoreceptors is to get rid of waste products. Just like in our kitchen here, there are waste products, and we compost them. Cells of the body make waste products, too. They take in glucose and things and oxygen, and they generate things like lactate, which is a chemical that's a waste product. And you have to get that waste product away from photoreceptors, just like you have to get the garbage away from us, or we'd get sick. And the photoreceptors would get sick, too. So the choriocapillaris also carries away the waste product. So it does those three things. It brings energy, it keeps the eye cool, or the temperature that it wants to be, and it carries away waste products. So that's the retina. If we look head on, if we look through the pupil at the eye with a thing called a fundus camera, this is sort of what we see. And I haven't drawn it very well, but things are sort of nicer. Here's we see a blind spot, which is this nerve head here.
light that falls there is not image. It's, we don't, there's no photoreceptors here. But we see from that all these red arteries taking blood out into the retina and the blue veins taking it back. And there are a lot of small vessels that come off of this too, which I didn't draw. And here almost directly behind the pupil, almost directly on the optic axis, if you just sort of shot a something right straight in the eye, you would come very close to hitting the middle of the macula. Not quite, but very close. And that's the region of highest vision. That's where the cones are very dense, and there are no rods. There are no rods. There's a lot of cones, and they're very close together. The spacing of the rods and cones varies over the retina. The cones are very tightly spaced here. They're less tightly spaced as we get away from the macula, and the cones are out throughout the retina, out in these regions, out and away from the macula. Right in the middle of the macula, there's an area that's called the fovea. That's where the cone density is absolutely the greatest. So that's where you have the sharpest vision. So when you focus on something, when you look at something, you're reading something, the light is going on the fovea. Around what you're focusing on, it's a very hard experiment to do, but if you look at something, let's say a big screen with a lot of letters on it or something, you look at the letter in the middle, and you concentrate, you see it sharply, and if you don't move your eye, but you try to see the letters around it, they're sharp, but not as sharp. And the further away you get from where you're looking, the less sharp the letters get. And that's because the photoreceptor density, the closeness of their path, moves from the fovea to the middle. Yeah.
Is that why you can go like this and look through a little pinhole and see something clear, really clear, a long ways away?
That's a little different. That's what you're doing when you're looking through a little pinhole, and you can see sharper. Is you're making the, you're basically reducing the size of the pupil, if you want, or you're, it's like in a photographic camera, you're reducing the size of the aperture so that you get a sharper image. So that's you get a sharper image. That's a standard optical situation. You have it in photographic cameras, and you have it in the eye, and by doing that, you're basically making the pupil smaller. When you make the pupil smaller, you get less light through, but it is a sharp, you'll get a sharper image. So, yeah, you're going to get less scattering from the lens with that little, that smaller beam of light going in than you would without it. So you get that. Let's see, we had macular degeneration. That's a major problem in this country, and it's a very annoying problem. My father had it when he got older, and it was very annoying to him because he liked to read, and all of a sudden he couldn't read as well. And that, that was really a major problem for him because he couldn't do what he enjoyed so much.
What causes it?
We don't know what causes it. We don't know. We know what it is. What it is in this region where the macula is, you get various kinds of deposits in the tissue. There's two kinds, dry deposits and wet deposits, and we don't probably need to know those, but what the structure of those are. But you get crud, you get junk in this area in here. You get sort of deposits of something here, little globules of something that you'd like not to be there. What causes it and how to cure it has been studied for a long time. And there's still not a lot known about it. There's a great desire to cure it because it gets, as we are living longer, people are having more problems with macular degeneration. And it's all this junk that gets in there. And the photoreceptors, some of them die, and you sort of lose your sharp vision in this area, either because of photoreceptor death or because of just crud that develops so the light doesn't get to the photoreceptor. What do we know about the causes of it? Well, it's probably well accepted that diet is a factor. What you eat is important. So It's not known why. People thought, well, you know, carrots are good for you. Let's just feed people a lot of carrots. Well, in Boston, there was a group over at the over Harvard Medical School. They fed people so many carrots, they turned yellow.
Yeah. John
it didn't have an effect.
They could see better, though.
They couldn't see any better. That was the problem. They could see better, they would be happy to be yellow. But they tried that. Yeah. They've tried the National Eye Institute, who funds research for these purposes, has spent a lot of money trying to find out causes and cures for macular degeneration. So far, they haven't found much. It is believed to be dietary cause. My father had it at a very young age, younger than I am now. I don't have it. But we eat differently. He was a big meat eater, and he ate a lot of fat. He used to scold me for not eating the fat on the beef and the whatever. And I said, no, I don't like that. And he said, oh, this is the best part. And he would eat a lot of fat. I don't eat much fat. Maybe that's the reason. Red meat is harmful in a lot of ways, and we like it, and I like it, but I try to limit it. And so diet, vegetables and fruits are good for you, and all the things that they tell us are probably good for the macula. But what causes it, I don't know. How you eliminate it, I don't know. I don't think anybody knows. The government is trying to find out. They're spending a lot of money trying to find out. So far, it's...
Is it hereditary?
It might be hereditary. But, again, my father had it, I don't have it. We got the same genes, so it's probably, if you had to pick one thing that was most important, it's probably diet. But what you should eat, I don't know. It might be that various kinds of vitamins and minerals and antioxidants are good. The eye is very sensitive to these things called free radicals, which are very harmful to the eye, and you get them in polluted environments. You get them in tobacco smoke. My father was a big smoker. I stopped smoking at a fairly young age, and it got me too much trouble to keep a pipe lit, and I stopped. I don't do this anymore. I'm busy. So, because tobacco has a lot of not only carcinogens in it, it has a lot of free radicals that get into the body that can cause changes, and yeah.
What about surgical procedures to correct macular degeneration?
Well, I don't know of any.
I had a friend who had a procedure that was related to macular degeneration, and in fact, it was not successful.
What did they do?
I'm not really sure. I don't know whether they corrected something, the iris or the retina.
Well, I don't know. Just like in religion, in medicine, there are a lot of false prophets. And you go to an eye doctor, and he tells you, he's wonderful at doing this, and he has no complications, and don't believe him, he has complications. Well, get a second opinion. He might be right. He might be really good. I don't know of any. There are some experimental procedures going on that they are doing retinal transplantation. Very experimental. And that's the kind of thing that would cure macular degeneration, maybe. But that's very experimental. It's still kind of in the research lab, and I hear people talk about it, and it's very exciting work, but it's not ready for prime time.
That's what hers was. It was some kind of surgical procedure to retard the progression of the disease.
Well, there are diseases of the retina that they can retard. Like in diabetics, they get problems where the blood vessels are very weak in the eye, and the blood vessels leave. And you get new vessels being formed, called neovascularization. And you can get new vessels being formed, and they will break and leak. And that causes blindness, because all of a sudden you get a lot of blood here in the back of the eye, and you can't get light through it. So there are surgical procedures for that, where they basically make spot wells on the back of the retina. They burn little pieces of tissue all over, and that seems to stop this new blood vessel formation where the walls are breaking, and stops the thing. So it could be that. I mean, somebody could have an idea, well, there's going to be too many vessels here. If I take all the burns here, that will slow down the burn. That's one of these very experimental things. So anyway, macular degeneration is, eat well, and Not a lot of known, but there's a lot of research going on about it. It's a very active area of research.
May I ask another question, please?
Yeah.
My grandmother had macular degeneration, and she tried to describe it to me, and I just didn't understand. But she talked about black in the middle of both eyes. I mean, that she just couldn't see in the center of her eyes. There was some peripheral vision. And yet, she could see some tiny bit of dust on the floor.
She just knew it was there.
She knew it was there.
She knew I was
keeping ass. Well, no, you can have that. Macular degeneration is something that affects the vision of what you're looking at. But you still have peripheral vision, and you can see things,
you see people,
you know, away from the macula.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, she might have just had right here in the middle of the macula. She the photoreceptors had all died. It all died, so she couldn't. It was a blind spot, a big black spot. Uh-huh. Couldn't read. But a little away from that, you still have vision. So you can see things if you're not looking at them. And dust you can see, you can often see if you're not looking at it.
So can you retrain yourself to read? I mean, if you can't...
Maybe. There are surgical procedures at Columbia University. There's a fellow who developed some years ago a way of putting in... They take out the lens and they put in a sort of an artificial lens. And then they put a lens on the outside, and this forms a telescope. So what it does is it enlarges the image on the retina, so now you are sort of seeing a magnified image, and that enabled a lot of people to see. But you've got, and that's still going on. It's gotten better recently than it was 10, 15 years ago.
I know what she's talking about. Haven't you seen those advertisements in the Reader's Digest where, you know, I remember seeing one where it says if you look and you see two black spots on the page ahead of you or one black spot, well, your eye doctor because you've got
right.
And
right.
Am I the only one who's seen those?
No, I mean you can develop.
No, the advertiser.
The advertiser.
No, floaters are different. Floaters are sort of debris floating around in the aqueous humor, tissue that comes off little streams, and they sort of float around. And this area here, the aqueous humor, is sort of salt water. It's basically salt water, and things can float around in it. And those are the floaters, and you see them. Moving in. That's something that comes with age, that you know, you hit your head and a little bit of tissue comes off and floats around and doesn't get washed out. And
does that go away with a cataract surgery?
No.
Yeah,
don't hit your head.
Probably not.
Don't get a good idea. Right?
They seem to disappear.
Yeah, because they settle down in the bottom of the eye or they don't stop floating. If you shake your head, they'll come back. And
it's kind of like
that. Yeah,
what about the light spots? Every now and then, you know, you can get electrical lights. You go to sleep, you know, shut your eyes and you get sparkling. You get sparks.
Oh, I get it.
You know, besides 4th of July. You know,
you open your eyes and close them, it goes away.
You know,
yeah, that's a phenomena. That's not a necessarily a disease okay. phenomena. It's just a the photoreceptors can be energized by light and sometimes by pressure and things. If you push on your eyes and then open it away, you can see it. Or there's various things that could cause that. If it's a bother, then you go to an eye doctor. Either an optometrist or ophthalmologist. And if it's a surgical problem, the optometrist will refer you to the ophthalmologist.
You'd better go to the ophthalmologist first, then.
Not necessarily. Ophthalmologists do not like to do routine eye exams.
Yes.
They are surgeons, and they like to do surgeons. That's what they're trained to do. That's what they enjoy doing. That's why they became an ophthalmologist. And they're less apt to like to look at your eyes and say, oh, well, yes, you know, your floaters are there. It's boring to him.
Yeah.
But to the optometrist, he likes that. I mean, that's his thing. He likes to find things. He's much better at looking at eyes and telling what's wrong. But he can't do surgery, except in a few states where he can. Those states he cannot.
Did you mention what glaucoma was?
Glaucoma is an increased... Conventional wisdom is it's increased pressure of the eye. And this, if in the aqueous humor, there's this fluid, all the fluids, particularly in the aqueous humor, have to be replaced. They can't be unchanged because of the waste product problem. Because the cornea is generating waste products. And those waste products have to be washed out.
They're either washed out in the tears or they're washed out in the aqueous humor. So you have to have new aqueous humor going out. So you have sort of a, like a stream going through. And in glaucoma, what happens is that there's a couple of kinds, but in the most common kind, the stream fills up the lake, but the outflow channels are clogged. So it can't get out as fast. So unlike a lake, if the outflow channel was dammed up, the lake rises and nothing bad happens. But this is a closed chamber. So if the outflow channels are clogged up, what you're going to do is you're going to build a pressure in there. And that pressure is going to be transmitted to all of the eye. And that pressure is going to kill some of the photoreceptors if you leave it untreated. And so you'll get blind spots in various places where the photoreceptors have died.
That's glaucoma.
Well, yeah, they can usually fix it. That you can pretty successfully fix it these days, either with drug treatments. There are drugs you can take which reduce the inflow. They reduce the size of the stream coming in here. There's also surgical methods. They can take a laser and they can zap the laser and open up these outflow channels that are clogged. So they can do it that way too. So glaucoma is one of these things that if you go to the eye doctor, and again, it could be an optometrist as well as an ophthalmologist, either one, and they will measure, or you could, sometimes there are vans coming around and you just go, you get a glaucoma test. If you catch it early enough, it's treatable. Usually it's
with drops.
It is with drops.
And the drops are the drugs you're speaking of?
The drops are the drugs, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there are several good drops now, and that's, you just take them regularly. And that's a disease that has been largely eliminated as a major problem in the last 20 years or so.
Does it tend to happen to everybody?
No, it doesn't tend to happen to everybody. It happens to selected people. We don't know who. You can't tell. Yeah, well, it may be. There's a lot of interest now, even in the National Institute, on molecular biology, the genetics of things. If we know the gene map of the human being, we can tell what diseases are going to get and what they won't get, and that kind of thing. So there's a lot of interest, even in eye research, on this sort of genetic mapping. Can we tell who's going to get glaucoma and who's not? But we're not there yet, and I don't know. Can we tell who's going to get macular degeneration and not? How important is diet and environmental things? And we're not there. But that's one of the paths they're following down. And, well, we haven't gotten to all these things. We could...
That was the later one.
Okay, the laser surgery. I talked about the cornea. The cornea is the most powerful lens associated with the eye. It does most of the refraction. So light that's coming in the eye gets focused. It sort of comes in and it focuses at some place on the retina hair. And you like to be sharply focused. Well, you know, just like in a camera, you have maybe a lens here, and if it's a complex camera lens, you have several lenses. In the eye, we have two. Well, both lenses are important in focusing the light on the film, the light from the tree or whatever we're focusing on the film. Well, in the eye, both these lenses, the cornea and the crystalline lens, are important lenses in focusing. The one that is the strongest, that does the most focusing, is the cornea. Rather than the crystal lens. The crystal lens focuses, but it's not the most powerful lens. The cornea is the most powerful, but it doesn't focus. So the two together work together nicely. So when the cornea has a shape, I don't want to say abnormal, because it's not necessarily abnormal, but the cornea can have a shape such that you can see fine without glasses. And if you're young, you can focus, you can see, you can read, you can see in the distance, fine, you don't need anything. But not everybody is like that. Some people, have to have glasses at a very early age because they can't see over all these distances. So there are people that, for example, in order to read, and they have to wear very, very thick glasses, spectacles, and that's annoying. So they want a way of, can I throw away my glasses and see? Well, there have been a couple of techniques developed for doing that, for being able to see without your glasses. And those all are surgical changes in the cornea.
because you can get to the cornea. It's up front. You poke your eye, you poke your finger and you hit the cornea. You can change the cornea. You can cut it. You can modify it. You can change it. The earliest type of surgery that was done on the cornea to change its shape. If you change its shape, you'll change its lens properties. So that's what you want to do. You want to change its shape so that it will focus light on the retina. The earliest type of surgery that was done, about 1941. It was done in, guess where? Japan. And on guess who? Kamikaze pilots. Because kamikaze pilots couldn't wear glasses if they were going to dive their airplane into an American destroyer. Because if the glasses fell off, they couldn't see the smokestack. And so they had to be able to see without their glasses. So a man by the name of Sato developed a method where they took the cornea and they cut radial incisions in the cornea. It was the early dates of radial keratotomy, if some of you may know that word. Sato actually, he was a wonderful surgeon. He actually not only cut radial lines on the outside of the cornea, but he got inside the cornea and cut them on the back. Wonderful surgeon. I don't like what he did, but I can admire his skill as a surgeon. There was probably nobody in the world a better surgeon than he was, better eye surgeon. So he did that. He operated on kamikaze pilots, and then they could see. And nobody, I mean, they were going to die anyway, so nobody cared whether the surgery was going to last for a year. Didn't make a bit of difference. It had to last about a week. That's all. And it did. It lasted. Well, of course, what happened is that not all the war was over rather abruptly, and so there were pilots who had this surgery who didn't kill themselves. And I actually met one at dinner in Japan once years ago, and we got to talk to one another. I looked into this, and there were quite a large number of people that could be studied with this kind of early radial keratotomy. A lot of them went blind eventually, but not all of them. So then later, this technique of radial keratotomy came about, and it's Fyodorov in Russia was given credit for it because he said, yeah, there was an accident in some young boy or something. The windshield broke and his eye was all scratched up by the windshield charge, and he found that, oh, gosh, all of a sudden he could read without glasses. So he said, well, if I cut the incisions, why, you know, maybe that will enable you to read without glasses. So he did, and then the Americans took it out. But actually it was first done in Japan, and that was radial keratotomy. And that was an attempt to change the shape of the cornea by cutting these radial incisions. And you know, how long they were and how many they were was you had to determine experimentally, and you know, usually you kind of like 8 incisions would work or something, and they couldn't be too close in, but and that was radial keratotomy, and that worked. That was popular in this country for quite a few years. But there were complications and it didn't always work, and so people tried to find other ways, and there were ways of taking and putting on a hot, warmer than the cornea material, and heating the cornea, and that would sort of shape it. You would heat it, and it would retain that shape for a while when you took off this thing that you put on. But that didn't last. The cornea went back to its original shape very soon. One of the things that the cornea does that we actually found in my lab, and other people have found it too, is that the cornea wants to go back to its original shape. You change it, it doesn't like to be changed. It'll go back to what it was. It'll regress to what it was. Most bodily tissues do that. So the thermokeratoplasty it's still being used. It's been modified, but it sort of got replaced when lasers became involved. The laser is a wonderful instrument for destroying tissue. It's the old, the death ray. You shine the laser on somebody and you vaporize them and whatnot. Well, that's sort of what you do in laser surgery. You shine the laser on the tissue and you vaporize it. You burn it away. And if you do it in a controlled way, you can take away certain parts of the cornea and leave other parts, and you will reshape the cornea so all of a sudden you can see without glasses. So in the common type of laser surgery called LASIK, L-A-S-I-K, what they do is they take the cornea, I'll draw it kind of as a big thing. They take the cornea and they will first cut a little flap here and then they'll throw it. So they'll take off the top of the cornea, with a special, a little instrument called a microkeratome. And that's where the skill of the surgeon is very important. You want a good surgeon that has good hands. You want him to have a good night's sleep before they do the surgery on you. You want to find out how many has he done. You're going to do laser, find out how many LASIK surgeries he's done. If he says, well, I've now done 10, you don't want to go to him. If he says, well, I've done about 5,000 already, that's probably a good guy. And he asks him, what's your success rate? If he says, he has no complications, you probably want to go somewhere else. Because there's about a 2-5% complication rate. But some of the things that are annoying are not considered complications. So the success rate as far as the people who haven't done this, there's probably about a 10% lack of what they want, lack of success. But anyway, so the surgeon cuts away the top part, and then he takes it and focuses the laser on it, and he basically destroys. He burns away some of the tissue in a proper shape. He could cut it away with a knife, but that's pretty hard. It's a lot easier to burn it away with a laser. So he burns away. Then he puts the flap back, and then maybe put a bandage on or something, and you'll go home. It's done as an outpatient thing. It's a very simple thing. You lay down there, and it goes zap zap zap, and they do it. I've seen it done. You'll notice I still wear glasses. I spent so many years studying the complications of surgical procedures. And when I go to medical meetings, they talk about the complications. So I know all about complications. They don't talk about the successes they've had. That's not of interest to anybody. They talk about the problems, and I know too many problems. If you are interested in laser surgery, then I won't tell you it's not for you, because it might be, but a good place to look, to read about is look at the, there's a website, surgicaleyes.com. It's a website that was started by somebody who had problems with laser surgery and felt that he wasn't told by the eye doctor what the problems were and the problems, So it has a lot of letters from people who have undergone laser surgery and the problems they've had. And it's not really anti-laser surgery, it's more of an informative thing. And they're trying to work with ophthalmologists to try to improve the techniques. And, for some people it may be good.
Does it last?
Yeah, what about long term?
You're asking somebody who spent a lot of years studying changes of the cornea, how it goes back to what you did to it. There are regressions in laser surgery that are now admitted. Most ophthalmologists love to do it because it generates income for them.
Yeah.
It's a way of regaining the income that they have lost because of Medicare reimbursements being cut.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a funny market. A lot of them don't want to hear about regression problems, but usually are some.
Even if the surgery, even if there wasn't regression, there would still be your eyes continue to age. You can,
right.
But your body continues to age,
right.
And your eyes continue to they continue to age, and the
change.
Flexibility of your eyes is less.
Right.
So your vision worsens on its own.
Right.
So you continue to increasing need for glasses just because of age.
So even if it's successful, it may not be successful for all of your life unless you don't live very long.
Become a comatose.
Yeah. probably wouldn't want it.
It's not going to be a permanent cure regardless, because you continue to age.
That's right.
Like a facelift.
But it depends on, if you're... If you're
it lasts longer than a facelift, probably.
Yeah. If you're a young person and you have... If you have that surgery and it allows you to go scuba diving or snorkeling or skydiving or something like that without the use of glasses, which that can be a whole life change.
Sure, mm-hmm. Sure. Absolutely.
Yeah.
I think what's important to look at, I'm fairly nearsighted, and when I look at charts of how my eyesight would be corrected with the surgery, it probably wouldn't be 20/20. It would be like 20/40.
Might be.
Well, I don't want to have the surgery because with my contacts, I can see 20/15. And I'm so used to that.
Right.
Then I just tried those bifocal contacts. That drove me nuts. That,
I have two. I wear glasses.
This is from one eye.
They're multifocal.
My eyes.
Now I can tell.
Some people like them. Some people just can't stand them.
No,
I can't stand
them. My ophthalmologist tells me that I'm at risk for cataract surgery because I don't have enough of those. So many of those little, whatever it is that holds the crystalline lens in place.
Yeah.
Is that a common problem?
No, I don't know. That I've not heard of. I've never heard of anybody not having enough of the muscle
line.
Or having fewer. I've never heard of that.
Sure.
So he may be right.
He says wait as long as you can.
That's true. Wait as long as you can. Wait as long as you have the cataract surgery. Because it you will not be better. You will be different after the cataract surgery. It won't necessarily be better because you will lose the ability to focus. That's what you'll lose. And so you're going to have to wear glasses, and you're going to have to wear a different pair of glasses for every distance that you want to see, or you're going to have to wear multifocals. And you'll just have to get used to them. They'll be annoying, and you'll just have to get used to them because you either that or you carry around five pair of glasses with you. There's this belt on you. We won't have folks
anymore.
When we're finished with this, could you go to the supplements for eye health?
Yeah, well, we're actually already out of time, but I'm happy to talk for as long as people want to put off lunch. So, I don't. Eye supplements for health. There are. That gets into this business also of what we might call alternative medicine. There are people around who say, yes, you should have these eye supplements for your health of your eye, for your health of your body. And, you know, for years and years, the medical community has sort of poo-pooed those and said, well, you don't need those. If you eat properly, you're going to get enough of it. Well, that's just recently changed. And now I think the medical profession is coming around and saying, well, no, maybe we should be taking vitamins and minerals and whatnot. Now, supplements for the eye. There has been, back about 10 years ago, there was a lot of funded studies coming out, funded by the National Eye Institute, on what kinds of things could we take as supplements to eliminate, particularly macular degeneration, which is a major problem, but other eye problems. And, you know, should we be taking antioxidants? Should we be taking a lot of vitamin A? A lot of vitamin E. Vitamin E is an antioxidant. Vitamin C. Should we take vitamin C? Here's Linus Pauling pushed vitamin C for so many years that he made everybody angry at him. A lot of people angry at him. And he was probably right, actually. But at the time, he was considered a crackpot, even though he had won two or three Nobel Prizes. The establishment considered him a crackpot because he was pushing vitamin C so hard.
Andrew Weil,
he's one of these people who pushes supplements. And he may be right. He's a physician, he's an MD, and he's got all the standard training of a medical doctor. And he's sort of on the fringe of medicine, and he pushes supplements. Well, I don't know, he may be right. He may not be. I don't know that. This is this business of false prophets again. You have to know who to believe. The supplement companies, the people that are selling it, they want you to buy it because they make money from it. They say, oh yeah, take this, and they'll find people who said, yeah, I took these pills for 3 months and now I can see and I couldn't before, and the pills only cost you $150 a month, and you should, you gotta know what axe they're grinding to know how much to believe them. Supplements are probably good. I take multivitamins every day and mineral supplements. I don't know whether they're helpful, but I do know that they don't harm me. And when I went to Harbor Freight Tools and had a multivitamin and minerals, and there were big boxes with Art Ulean's things, and they only cost me $1.50 a bottle, and then there was $1.50 refund if I mailed in this thing, I figured, well, I might as well buy 3 bottles. They don't cost me anything. They're not going to hurt me. They don't taste very good, but it's probably going to get rid of them. But they're probably helpful. So supplements are probably good. When you read statements about how wonderful they are, just read it you know, be a little skeptical and go to other sources too. But things like vitamin E are probably good. Vitamin A, of course, if you don't get vitamin A from carrots and things, why, that's essential for good vision. And vitamin C is good, not necessarily in massive doses. Too much is not good either, but probably good. It depends on, but if you go to Walgreens, you can buy multivitamins that are probably as good as you buy in the supplement incorporated and wants to sell you things at $20 a bottle. And I have an optometrist friend in Portland, in Beaverton, who he reshapes the cornea by putting a special big lens on the cornea, and you sleep with it on. Mm-hmm. And it changes the shape of the cornea, and when you wake up, you take it off, and your vision, it corrects your vision for a day or two. orthokeratoplasty or whatever. And that's something which, back when I was a kid, my optometrist said it was good. Nobody believed it. The medical profession just didn't believe that at all. Now it's gotten to the point where, yeah, it can be shown to work. And that's there are problems with keeping lenses on the cornea all day, all night, because you can't wash away the waste products. So your cornea is sitting in this aqueous sewer, or the sewer of waste products. But so it depends. If that bothers you, you don't go to use his method if it doesn't. And he has some success. But he is a great believer in supplements. And he was trying to convince me to buy these because now he can move. And he used to be able not be able to sit down and get up and all that. And he took these, and they're wonderful. I look into it. You know, it's like it's one of these programs, like these weight loss programs, you know. And buy these things, and it's $200 a month, and you have to take them for years. And I said, I'd rather, when I get up, be a little stiff. And,
yeah.
Yeah, I'll work it out. Not a minute, but for some people, they...
Is there any prevention for nearsightedness?
None. That's just the aging of the eye. That's the fact that as the lens... Well, let me take that back. As the lens ages, it gets hard, and the muscles are unable to reshape it as much as they would like.
That's the presbyopia.
Well, that's both. That's both.
Because I've been nearsighted since I was 8 years old.
Yeah. Well, you're nearsighted since 8 years old because the cornea is, the shape of your cornea is such that in order to be able to see sharp, you had to wear glasses. Mm-hmm. These issues of presbyopia and nearsightedness, farsightedness, are all associated either with, if there's something that has just come, as opposed to you were born with it. If something has come, it's usually associated with the lens not being able to change its shape as easily as it could, you know, 5 years ago or 10 years ago. If it's something you've always had, then it's most likely a problem of the cornea is not the right shape to focus on.
So laser surgery could fix it?
Laser surgery can, in principle, fix that. And that's why people have laser surgery. Like pilots who have to fly without glasses, I mean, they lose their jobs if they don't do it. So they do it, and there are a lot of people who feel it's worth the risk. But if you're going to have it done, look on the internet, look at surgicaleyes.com, see what the complications are. Because there are problems that the patients have that the surgeons say, we don't consider those complications. The problems of driving at night, the problems of these halos that somebody asked about, those problems of glare. Because if you do any kind of surgery on the cornea here, you have, they don't do it over the whole cornea. They do it in a certain region. So maybe they will do it in this region. Let's say inside the green area, they will change the shape of the cornea, because that's part of the cornea you see through. When you're looking at something, the light only goes through the sort of the middle part of the cornea, not this outside part. So they reshape the middle part. The problem with that is that there's a border between the normal cornea that they didn't alter and the changed cornea. It's right here. This is the border. And at night, what happens is the light is less. The pupil gets bigger. And if the pupil gets as big as this circle that I've drawn, then all of a sudden you get light scattering from the corneal alterations that have occurred, from the scar tissue, if you will. You will have scar tissue in the middle of the cornea here. It'll be sort of in here. There'll be some scar tissue in here. The pupil gets big enough that the light is going through the area where the scar tissue is. The scar tissue will scatter light, and that's what we see as glare. So glare is light being scattered in the cornea and not focusing nicely on the retina. So at night, people that have had laser surgery often have problems when they drive. They see halos that come. The halos are on lights, and they see reduced contrast of things. They can't see the little kid walking on the street. They can't read the sign that says, turn off to Beaverton or whatever, so they drive by and they have to come back to another 10 miles.
I've done that for years.
So those are the kinds of things that you find on surgical eyes, that some of the people weren't told they would have these problems. And those are problems you can't avoid. Nobody knows how to burn away tissue without causing a
scar.
I guess a scar is the best word to use. It's, you know, you cut yourself while you get a little scar. Well, the same thing in the cornea. You cut the cornea, that was one of the problems with radial keratitis. When you cut these incisions like this, you would get scars formed around there, and those scars would scatter light. In the case of laser surgery, you get a sort of a circular scar, a little alteration in the stroma of the cornea, and that will scatter light and reduce contrast, and sometimes you raise the halos and things like that. So that's.
Have you followed any of the other techniques? I know two others. One was where I'd actually take the cornea out, freeze it, and recut it on a mechanical blade.
Yeah.
And then another one where they put. Call it a wedge insert to reshape it behind it. How are those compared to I know laser's popular because it's easy for them.
But. Yeah, this business of the first method was a method developed by an ophthalmologist in Columbia, Barracare. And they would excise, they would just take out a piece of the cornea.
Right.
They'd freeze it, they had this special tiny lathe, and they would put it in, and they would just reshape it by spinning it the way you machine metal. And they could do that on the frozen cornea because it's hard, and they would reshape it and put it back.
Amazing.
Well,
yeah.
I don't know. I mean, that's a lot of people, some people are still using that. There is no foolproof way to reshape the cornea. There's not a way that is used by everybody, and I don't know. I mean, that's certainly popular with Barracare. Another would be his following. He has a religion, a little group that says, oh, this is the way to do it. They have learned the technique, and they do it well. It's done in New Orleans now, and the people down there. And it's, again, sometimes it works well, sometimes it doesn't. What was the second method?
Where they're putting clear wedges in
right. The other way, that's another way of doing it, where you take the cornea and you cut a flap, they cut a flap, and then they insert something, or maybe they make a little incision, and they insert something to change the shape of the cornea, basically, or change the power, of the cornea.
Right.
That's just another experimental method. It's one that has had a resurgence recently, so that's why you know about it. Things like that were first done by a physiologist called David Morris, who's currently at Columbia University. He was at Stanford for many years. Mumbles a lot. Very hard to understand him when he's lucky or mumbles when he ever was actually. But he's very smart and very capable,
from
Britain, he's from London, and he's. But he did some experiments a long time ago, probably 30 years ago, where he did sort of the same thing. They would say insert lenses and things into the middle of the cornea to change the shape. And they had problems with these things rejecting. The cornea would reject them. But probably the biggest problem with them, and the reason it never caught on back then. And the people who are doing it now probably don't know the old literature. Scientific things have a way of recurring every so many years because the young people don't read the old literature, and they do the same thing. And the biggest problem, one of the biggest problems then was that you would have a cornea here. Here was your cornea, and in the middle you would have this plastic thing that you would put in, or this artificial material. Well, that's a problem because this thing, this solid stuff here, inhibits the flow of waste products through the cornea. And you got to get rid of the waste products. Cornea does not like to sit in the sewer any more than we like to sit in the sewer, and it's going to generate this lactate that you've got to get rid of. And it couldn't move through here and get washed out in the tears. It could go back here maybe and get washed out in the aqueous humor. But a lot of times you put these lenses up near the front. And maybe it's like this. This is the back and the front. So they would be up near the front. So normally these waste products would get washed out.
You're welcome.
Nice to
meet you, dear your eyes.
Oh, it helps a lot. I have this 5 scoops.
Good. I was hoping you'd say that.
That's right. Thank you.